Hello and welcome to the Oldies June podcast. D-Day took place 75 years ago on the 6th of June. It was the largest amphibious invasion in history. 7,000 vessels, over 156,000 personnel and 1,200 planes and gliders were involved in the invasion. Today we are joined by a historian and best-selling author of D-Day, A Soldier's Story, Giles Milton, who's penned a piece about D-Day for us in this month's magazine. So Giles, what were the Allies up against when they landed?
They were up against what was called the Atlantic Wall. This was a highly fortified wall that ran all along the shores of northern France. It consisted of concrete bunkers, machine gun nests, mines on the beaches, reams of barbed wire. So it was going to be very, very difficult for the Allies to land infantry onto the beaches into basically a kind of maelstrom of gunfire.
And so how did the fighting compare on the different beaches? Because you mentioned there's a massive sort of difference in beach to beach.
Yes, some beaches proved easier than others. It's easy to say that nowadays, certainly Utah Beach, which was one of the American beaches, was relatively easy. In fact, an extraordinary statistic is that more men were killed in the practice run in Devon than were killed on the day itself. Absolutely extraordinary. Omaha, of course, is famous from people who remember the film Saving Private Ryan. Omaha was an absolute massacre and very nearly a catastrophe for the Americans. The other beaches, they were all tough. Sword Beach, which was one of the British beaches, was tough, but luckily they had the commandos going in there who managed to, as the leader of the commandos, Lord Lovett, said, they sliced like a knife through butter through the German defences.
Interesting you mentioned Sword, because I know it was bloody but brief, so the first assault on Sword was not quite so successful.
Yes, I suppose in sort of any military battle, the old trick is not to send in your best troops first. So there was a poor, sort of unfortunate first wave that went in, not very well trained, and they were just gunned down. I mean, it was a massacre. And then, but they caused some damage to the German defences. So when the commandos went in about an hour later, they had the advantage of, the first bits of the wall, the Atlantic Wall, had been broken.
So in terms of the makeup of the Allied forces, who exactly did they have with them? Sort of, what were their sort of specialities? Where are they from?
The main bulk of the forces, they were American, they were British, and they were Canadian, basically. But of course, they were backed up by endless other troops. There were French troops were involved, there were Poles, there were Czechs. Lots of different nationalities were involved in smaller numbers. But the essentials are two beaches American, two beaches British, and one beach Canadian.
And so something which seems to come up quite regularly in the sort of the looks at D-Day is the weather. And D-Day was meant to go off in May, it was delayed, and then post D-Day there were some issues as well. What was all that about?
The problem was, it was one of the worst Junes in living memory, in terms of weather. It was the 5th of June, when the invasion was originally set to go, was on the 5th of June. It was just blowing a gale in the channel. It was incredibly stormy weather. And also, very importantly, very low cloud cover. And of course, if you've got low cloud cover, you can't use your planes, which were an absolutely essential ingredient for the Allies. So it got postponed to the 6th. And even on the 6th, when it went ahead, it was really touch and go. And, the accounts I've read of so many of the men were violently seasick on the way over. So they're landing into, a wall of gunfire, feeling absolutely awful.
And yet Bill Millen, Lord Lovett's Piper, didn't have the issue of being sick when he landed.
Well, he was extremely ill when he was crossing the channel, but somehow he managed to get up and blow his bagpipes and pipe the commanders ashore. Quite extraordinary, really.
And Rommel said of Normandy that it was where the Allies will land. Was this statement acted on?
Rommel always believed that the Allies would land in Normandy because he'd studied the landings in Sicily and Italy, and they'd landed on very similar beaches, and he felt sure they were going to land in Normandy. But others disagreed, notably Hitler, was convinced that the Allies would land in Calais because it's, of course, the shortest crossing across the Channel.
Interesting you mentioned Hitler. There were some issues with the Wehrmacht's high command. There's a failure to act, wasn't there? And an interaction with Rommel, which also didn't go so well.
Yes, because Rommel's argument, really, was that the Allies had to be defeated on day one. So as they came ashore, they had to be pushed back into the sea. And to do that, he required the panzer divisions, basically, the heavily armoured divisions, to come in and attack the Allies when they're still on the beach. They're feeling lousy, they're seasick, they're, in a bad way. So that was his idea, but Hitler disagreed and refused to release the panzers until later in the day, by which point it was simply too late because the Allies were ashore.
So when the actual landing was first sort of alarm was called, one of the generals contacted the Berghoff?
Yes, the news of the invasion was immediately phoned through to Bavaria, to the Berghof, to Hitler's headquarters. But then there was a problem, because Hitler had taken a sleeping tablet and no one dared to wake him up. And also they knew if they woke him up, he'd go into some great long rant which would last for about 3 hours, and no one wanted to listen to that. So they decided, I mean catastrophically really, they decided not to wake him up, to wait till the morning till he woke up naturally. And he woke up very late because he'd taken this sleeping draught, you know. Mm. And so that, it delayed the entire German response to the invasion.
Did that failure, I mean how much of a gift was that to the Allies?
I think it was a huge gift, because it meant that the Germans didn't bring in their mechanized divisions, their panzer divisions, until much later in the day. So it gave the Allies a good 6 hours, really, to consolidate themselves on the beaches and just inland before they faced the first German tanks coming towards them.
A lot is made of that, sort of the precarity of their position at the end of the first day. It almost seems like a reverse Dunkirk, in a sense, in that, you know, again, the panzers just weren't used. They weren't sent in to finish them off.
No, and I think, you know, it's an open question as to whether the Germans could have defeated the Allies on D-Day, but they could certainly have done a lot more damage, and they could have made the whole landings much more precarious, I think. So it was a really crucial mistake. As Rommel himself knew, this was a mistake not to bring in your heavy armoured divisions as early as possible.
And so one of the most iconic sort of images of D-Day has got to be sort of Lord Lovat and his piper Bill Millin. Who was Lovat?
Lovat, yeah, he's one of the more flamboyant characters on D-Day. The 15th Lord Lovat, a Scottish aristocrat, and he, 33 years of age, he was leader of the commandos. Greatly loved by his men, just because he had this incredible chutzpah, you know. I mean, only Lovat would have gone into battle wearing a monogrammed shirt and carrying a hunting rifle. And, as you say, bringing his Highland piper with him, who he wanted to be piped ashore. Extraordinary, really. And so that is exactly what happened on Sword Beach.
And how did he get his pipe onto the beach? It was it's against regulations.
It was against regulations. Yeah, he was absolutely told he wasn't allowed to do it. But he said, oh, that's the English saying that. I'm Scottish, so I can do what I want. So, yeah, he instructed Millin to walk up and down the beach playing the bagpipes. And a Millin later learned from German prisoners of war that the only reason they didn't shoot him because they thought he was completely mad.
Yeah. another interesting sort of element of Lovat is his sort of loathing and hatred of Evelyn Waugh.
Yeah.
Did he live up to Evelyn Waugh's characterisation of him as Trimmer?
The thing is, Lovat is a controversial character. Lovat was portrayed, of course, famously in the Hollywood movie The Longest Day, and this great, you know, incredibly colourful character who arrives at Pegasus Bridge. This is what he had to do. He had to get to Pegasus Bridge, and he arrives there. And what's his opening words? He says, he apologises for being 2.5 minutes late. It's a great line. Now, it's possibly true, we just don't know, but what we do know is that Lovat was historical consultant on the film The Longest Day, so he was able to write himself a really good character role for the film. Yeah, you're right, Evelyn Waugh really couldn't stand him, and there were a number of people who couldn't stand him, but a lot of his men really did, they loved him, they thought he was a great leader, and he led very well from the front.
Did he actually wear the sort of, was he actually in the white jumper, or is that just a bit of, is what, I've heard it was actually underneath his combat gear. But
yeah, and if you, there are photos as well, and it's so hard to know. I suspect that both the monogram shirt and the white jumper were under combat gear, yes.
Pity. But one of the interesting things about Lovat is also his involvement in the Dieppe raid. It's another sort of amphibious, complete disaster of an occasion.
Yeah.
So was it in 42?
Yes.
Yeah. And what, obviously that went terribly wrong. What lessons were learned between from Dieppe and the late amphibious landings?
Yeah, I mean, Dieppe was really, really important because it taught the Allies the difficulty of landing on a heavily defended shore, in fact. And so I think that the disaster there, and you know, so many people were killed in the Dieppe raid, that it taught them that they... the element of surprise was absolutely crucial. The necessity of coming ashore with heavily armoured vehicles. This led to the amphibious tanks that were used on D-Day very effectively on some of the beaches, completely ineffectively on other beaches, notably Omaha, where there was a massacre. Mm-hmm. So yes, they did learn from the serious mistakes of Dieppe.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, you mentioned the funky tanks. That's the Hobart's Funnies.
Hobart's Funnies, yes.
So what actually were they? What was special about them?
Well, this was the brainchild of a completely eccentric character called Sir Percy Stanley Cleghorn Hobart, who was put in charge with dreaming up weird and wonderful machines that would be able to support infantry on the beaches. So he designed, notably, the duplex drive tank, which everyone called the Donald Duck tank, because it was essentially a floating Sherman tank that would emerge from the sea. The Germans wouldn't know it was there, would emerge from the sea onto the beaches at the same time as the infantry. This was crucial because it meant that the infantry would arrive with heavy armoured support, basically. And there's a whole load of other tanks, modified tanks and vehicles. There's this incredibly powerful flamethrower, a really nasty thing which fired great sort of shots of petrol into German bunkers and incinerated everyone.
Placed the machine gun.
And then there were flail tanks to flail the mines, you know, all sorts of things, which, you know, he was pretty mad and eccentric, Hobart, but I think his machines did play an important role.
On topic of the ingenuity of the techies on the Allied side, tell us a bit more about the Mulberry Harbours.
Yeah, it was essential for the Allies to have a big port, a big harbour in France, because they were going to be landing, you know, millions of tons of equipment and millions of men as well. But the problem is they knew that Cherbourg, which was the only big port, it was going to be very hard to capture. So what did they decide to do? Well, they thought, we'll just bring our own harbour with us. So they towed this absolutely massive concrete harbour, these concrete caissons. They were towed over in pieces, and then they were assembled just offshore of the Normandy coastline. They brought two of them across, and they came across on the 6th of June itself. A really ingenious solution and something that completely outwitted the Germans. They never thought the Allies would do something like that.
They're still there, aren't they, as well? They're too big to be dismantled.
Well, bits of them are there. I mean, every year another bit sort of sinks to the bottom. And I think they are trying to list them as a World Heritage Site, actually. But even when you see them, they're just massive, you know. And they needed to be, because the amount of hardware that had to be brought to France was quite extraordinary.
And yet there was almost a complete disaster with them about 2 weeks into the invasion.
In fact, yeah, as I said earlier, the weather in June, that June was absolutely terrible. It was terrible on the 5th and 6th of June. It was even worse on the 19th of June, when there was a huge storm which actually destroyed one of the harbours completely. The other one was able to continue functioning. But yeah, that was a near disaster as well.
So with sort of the commemorations coming up, what exactly are we expecting to see? How is it going to be commemorated?
It's going to be huge, because I think a lot of people think or realise that this is the last big one where there will, you know, realistically be quite large numbers of veterans. You know, they're all in their 90s now. The youngest is 1991. So there's about 200-300 coming over from England. I think there's an enormous number coming from America. There's going to be a mass parachute drop into Normandy, which will be great. There's going to be a huge flyover of Dakotas. All the heads of state, heads of government are going to be there, celebrating it as well. So the festivities are planned over the course of a week. So it's going to be pretty colourful, and really I think this will be the last chance really to celebrate it with quite a number of those who were there on the 6th of June.
How do the French remember D-Day?
Well, obviously the French have been waiting for D-Day for years, and so in some ways they were absolutely delighted when the Allies arrived. But of course it was also, you know, they had a huge death toll themselves, French civilians, because the Normandy coastline is dotted with villages, and they were all inhabited at the time, and they found themselves under the heaviest naval bombardment in the history of warfare. So, you know, huge numbers were killed on D-Day, which, you know, introduced a sour note into it. Having said that, you know, years ago I interviewed lots of French civilians who were there at the time, and they remember opening their curtains on the 6th of June at dawn and seeing this massive Allied fleet, and they just, you know, they couldn't quite believe what they were witnessing. And those, you know, young children would remember, or have remembered that for the rest of their lives. This was the moment they've been dreaming of, you know.
Is it remembered with is it a positive national memory? Because there's, of course, it's sort of later on in the war, sort of post-war, you have the Gaullist sort of myth, as it were, about you know, the French sort of liberating themselves, and that whole sort of different narrative which was sort of constructed to sort of give France back a bit of national pride.
Yeah,
is it sort of Is it part of that narrative? Is it a positive element?
Well, what they're very proud of, and they always talk about, is the French contribution on the beaches. Now, it was tiny. It was 170 odd men with the commandos, commanded by Philippe Kieffer, who was a French commando who trained in Britain. They're very proud of that, and that gets a lot of media attention. You know, it was small, but it's something that they can show we were taking part in it. However, I think the role is much underestimated is the role of the resistance, who played a really key role in two areas. Firstly, in espionage. They were spying on the Germans and forwarding information to England in the weeks before, while the planning was, it was at the planning stage. And the other thing was, on the night itself, was blowing up bridges, blowing up railway junctions, blowing up key road junctions, to do anything they could to stop the German, you know, the panzer divisions being able to reach the beachheads. And this is not much written about, and Eisenhower himself said after the war that this was actually a key component in the success of D-Day.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Eisenhower, who's of course the sort of the commander-in-chief, yeah, of sort of all the Allied forces. He was in command of 1.5 million men in the sort of
extraordinary
something. How did he manage that? Of all these different countries, surely there must have been so much jockeying for power and position in that sort of
the wars. And I think his greatest role was less as a general and more as a diplomat. You know, he was actually able to keep. You have these such powerful personalities. You know, people like Monty. I mean, he was insufferable. You know, he managed to keep them all on board. It's interesting that Eisenhower looked at what Eisenhower did on D-Day itself, and actually he sat in his trailer reading cowboy novels for much of the day, because there was actually nothing to be done on D-Day itself. The plans had all been made, the men had been sent ashore. There was nothing that they could do in Portsmouth, you know. So he just had to keep his fingers crossed, really. Of course, he'd famously written two communiques, one announcing the success of D-Day and one announcing the failure, for which he took full responsibility. And he was obviously very relieved that he never had to use that letter.
Extraordinary. One of the interesting tales is Churchill was absolutely desperate to get across the Channel, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. Churchill wanted to be in the thick of it, and his ministers were absolutely in despair because he refused to be talked out of it. And it took King George VI himself to actually appeal to Churchill, and he said, look, I'm head of the armed forces and even I'm not going, so how can you possibly go? But really, it was really difficult. Churchill wanted to be there.
Was this in the sort of the first sort of, this was, he wanted to be there the day after the landing? Was
that he wanted to be there on D-Day. He wanted to witness D-Day, yeah. He wanted to be there on the 6th of June. And that's why everyone was saying, no, you know, Winston, this is a very bad idea.
So Giles, with this sort of an operation the size of D-Day, there must have been a fair bit of sort of, the need for deception was an important one. How did sort of operations like, plans like Operation Fortitude help the Allies?
Well, what the Allies wanted to do is convince the Germans that they were not going to land in Normandy. So they really wanted to persuade Hitler that they were going to land in the Calais area or elsewhere even. And so they put enormous, you know, they had double agents working for them to put out false information. They did whatever they could. They created whole fake divisions. They even created fake tanks. You know, they were made out of canvas and put on the ground all over the place. So any German reconnaissance plane flying over would see thousands of tanks, you know, near Dover. And obviously they put two and two together and make five. That was the idea. And it was largely very, very successful, because right until the last minute, the Germans did indeed think that the Allies would probably land in the Calais area. They were very, very taken by surprise when they landed in Normandy.
Mm-hmm. And so to move back sort of towards the beaches themselves and the immediate sort of breakout afterwards, what was the significance of Pegasus Bridge? It's one of the most famous sort of famous names of the entire landings.
Pegasus Bridge, yeah, was absolutely crucial. In fact, this was, you know, some hours before the beach landings, these men were flown in gliders, and they had to capture Pegasus Bridge and another bridge called Ranville Bridge. Why? Because these were at the eastern end of the beachhead, and if they hadn't captured those bridges, the German panzer divisions could have come across them and swept the Allies back into the sea. That's what Rommel wanted to do, in fact. So, and there were very few bridges across the canals and rivers. So by controlling, by seizing those bridges and holding onto them, it basically blocked any German counterattack. And when the Germans did counterattack later in the day, they had to make an enormous detour because they couldn't get across these two bridges. So it was a really, really vital operation.
So So how many men were holding the bridge? And who, there must have been a relief column as well.
Yeah, there was 181 of them. It was a very, very small party to attack the bridge. And this is why they were desperate for the commandos to arrive from Sword Beach, because the commandos were coming to relieve them. And it's sort of... Lord Lovett saw the significance of this. It was a beleaguered force holding out on these two bridges in the middle of nowhere. You know, it really appealed to his sense of British military history. And so I think that's why he was delighted to be leading this force that was going to relieve these men, you know.
In terms of the pivotal role of Pegasus Bridge, is it sort of relatable, similar in significance to the Pointe du Hoc?
Was another sort of iconic moment of D-Day. Pointe du Hoc had the big German guns on top, or at least it was believed to. This was the American Rangers that had to climb these, scale these enormous cliffs, you know, on wet ropes, which were heavily defended at the top, capture the cliff top, and then try and find the guns, which they did. It was a very difficult operation. They eventually found the guns, and they blew them to kingdom come, basically. So again, a very successful operation, but boy, did they take a lot of casualties. You know, it was they were really hit hard by the German defences.
Yeah, and the Americans really had the worst of it. As
they really did. I'm certainly on Pointe du Hoc and on Omaha Beach. Omaha was just a massacre for the first few hours, anyway. Mm.
So before D-Day even took place, it was almost discovered, wasn't it? There was a sort of a tale with a crossword involved.
Yes, this is the famous Telegraph crossword story, which was, of course, there were lots of code names being used on D-Day, particularly for the names of the beaches, you know, Utah, Omaha, Sword, Juno, and Gold. And these words started mysteriously cropping up in the Telegraph crossword in the weeks before D-Day. And planners sort of wondered what earth was going on, as some German spies got hold of this or something. It transpired, it seems, that the headmaster who wrote these crosswords for the Telegraph had been talking to some of the lads who were going to go ashore and had picked up some of the code words for the beaches, and inadvertently he started putting them into the crossword. So it seems it was completely innocent, but it was a rather alarming breach of security, yeah. Really.
Yeah, yeah. So sort of John Buck and son, Lord Tweedsmuir, slightly lost the plot. Well, I think on that cheerful note, Giles, I think we will end this wonderful podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.